have you been?
Good.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is March 21st, 2017. And the first items on the agenda, we're going to combine public hearings in House Bill 2104 and 2105.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, we have two related bills in House Bill 2104 and 2105. Both were brought to us by Representative Gorsuch. House Bill 2104 would require corrections employers of security personnel to pay employees three times the regular rate of pay for mandatory overtime that is over 40 hours in a week. And it removes the exemption from required overtime pay for security personnel and corrections. And there are no amendments. House Bill 2105 would create the Department of Corrections Budget Oversight Commission to advise the Governor and Director of DOC and make legislation recommendations regarding management and implementation of DOC's biannual budget, including looking at employee overtime and health care expenses. There is a Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment increases membership in the commission from 11 to 13 people and increases the term lengths for first appointed members. The Dash 1 also changes the effective date to July 1st, 2017. Both of these bills have swept subsequent referrals to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you. Joe Basler, Roger Ware, and Tim Wohl.
Oh, can I?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, please go ahead. First, hang on a second. Hmm.
And this time I promise I will wait until all questions are finished before I try and flee the table here. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson, in absentia, and members of the committee. My name is Chris Gorsuch, and I am the state representative for House District 49, which is East Multnomah County. I'm here today to testify on behalf of House Bill 2104 and 2105. As you know, like many of our state agencies, the Department of Corrections is currently receiving less than adequate funding. The resulting unintended consequences from this have come down hard on the shoulders of their correctional staff, or their correction staff. On a recent visit to Columbia River Correctional Facility, I saw corrections officers who were responsible for supervising the recreation yard and dormitories where the inmate population far outnumbered the staff. This underscores, obviously, the skill and capability of those officers, plus the cooperation of the inmates, but it puts the staff in a very precarious position if something should go wrong. I believe that this creates stress, which leads to an erosion of the health and well-being of the corrections officers. Evidence of this stress can be seen in the fact that heart disease, divorce, and suicide rates for correctional staff are higher than the national average. Further stress comes from DOC's longtime need to require mandatory overtime and delayed vacations. Thus, we can see a workforce that has been pushed well past what would be considered fair and reasonable. Please keep in mind that this situation is not as serious as it could be due to the hardworking folks, both the leadership and the staff at the Department of Corrections, who have found ways to do more with less, but it needs to be rectified nonetheless. Insufficient funding is a legislative problem that Director Peters and her staff are constantly grappling with. However, I believe that their job in that respect could be improved by spreading responsibility for budget discussions out to include a broader board of professionals. Some of those professionals could come from areas of the criminal justice system that are often part of the upstream pressure that is placed on the Department of Corrections. This board could make for better informed allies in the attempt to sustain the quality and effectiveness of DOC operations under such challenging conditions. It could also build awareness and sympathy for the challenges that result from not having enough revenue or trying to find ways to reduce our current prison populations, which is something that is actively going on right now. The board would not fix all of the problems, overtime and so on, faced by DOC, but I believe that it could certainly help with those issues. This concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Just one really quick, thanks, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Gorsuch,
yeah.
A lot of it is just the relationship of what you're describing between what's happening with management and labor,
right?
Involved in that. Are you aware that there is any type of movement toward discussion around that and with between the director's office and those? I mean, because let's face it, that's got to happen.
Right. Representative Barker, Representative Olson, I believe so, but I won't say for sure. I do have some folks that are going to come behind me that would know that better. From the impressions I've gotten from discussions with both groups, I think that's been happening.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Representative.
All right. Thank you.
And now we'll call it again. Joe Basler, Roger Ware, and Tim Woolery. You go in any order, but remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME, and we requested that Representative Gorsuch would put these bills in for us, and we thank him so much. The biggest complaint since I've been with AFSCME now for 11 years, and one of the biggest complaints from the Department of Corrections folks we've had is the overwork and how that overwork leads to poor health outcomes. And it's becoming it's sort of a constant drumbeat that's always been there, and it's always gotten worse, and there's a lot of data to show how poorly those health outcomes have been coming up. We know it's a super complicated issue that has to do with folks not being able to take their vacation time, so then they get ill, and then they take sick time, and the sick time forces the department to have to use a lot of overtime, and then when you use a lot of overtime, people get more sick and more unwell, and then they have to take more. It sort of becomes this spiral. And so we came up with different solutions. And so HB 2104 and 2105 are both attempts to sort of get at the same thing. Right now, we wanted 2104 that times three for mandatory overtime is a stick, right? It is the idea that let's make it so fiscally foolish to have mandatory overtime that they stop doing it. That's the point of the bill. I think it's really clear that bill isn't going to work the way it is. We know, for instance, that DOC's tracking of mandatory overtime is not really. It's hard to do. We also know that it's hard to define what exactly is mandatory overtime, and that some of my compatriots will talk about that in a little more detail. But we did think we need to put something out there to force the issue, to have the conversation about why we're having so much mandatory overtime. I think in 2016, from DOC numbers, looking at those, it's about $13 million was spent in mandatory overtime. Overtime in general, not mandatory overtime. We're not sure how much of that is mandatory. DOC thinks it's probably 35% of it's mandatory. We think in some places it's as much as 40%. We actually have a breakdown by institution in my testimony, which is on OLIS right now, and she look at some of the institutions. Coffee Creek Institution, for instance, had almost 70,000 hours of overtime. Some of the institutions have very little. The State Pen actually has quite a bit. So there's a lot of variation. It leads to the fact that this is a really complicated problem, which we also understand, and maybe one quick solution isn't the way to go. So that brings us also to House Bill 2105, which creates an oversight committee to the Department of Corrections to look deep into their budget and really specifically focus on the use of overtime and the use of how that affects the health outcomes for our membership that impact the budget overall. We think that's probably a better way to do it. Bring more stakeholders in, have a more transparent look at these problems, and really start to dig in. A lot of times in many sessions, we come forward and say, you know, please give us more money so we can hire more people and fix this problem. And I think this time we understand that it's a tight budget, so we're asking you to help us dig deeper and look harder and try to figure out what's the best solution. It's been a problem for a long time, and I don't think it's going to get fixed in any one session. So that's why we brought these bills forward. And I'll let my other compatriots talk about this a little bit more. Thank you.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee. A little bit about me. My name is Roger Ware. I was a 17-year veteran correctional officer for the Oregon Department of Corrections. 3 years ago, I chose to leave DOC, and now I work full-time for AFSCME. I represent Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution and Two Rivers Correctional Institution. I wanted to come talk to you today a little bit about the bill and about overtime and how it affects the line staff that work these day in and day out. Depending on who you talk to and how they calculate their numbers, they can make the numbers say what they want depending on what information they use. What I want to talk to you a little bit about is how it actually affects the line staff. When you come to work, you have your first shift, which is our graveyard shift that covers for our day shifts. In other words, we have the smallest amount of people we have employed covering for the largest shift that we have. So at an institution, I may have 20 people on graveyard, and I'm going to run 45 on day shift or 50 on day shift. So it's twice as many staff. Therefore, I get bucketed, what we call bucketed or mandatory overtime, almost twice as much. I've got people that have been bucketed three times in 1 week. And what the bucket means is when you work, depending on what your shift is, and I'll use the institution that I represent out at EOCI, their graveyard shift runs from midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning. It's a straight 8 shift. Their day shift then runs from roughly 8:50 to 4:30 in the afternoon. And when you get bucketed, you're basically stuck at the institution from midnight to 4:30 in the afternoon. Some of these people live upwards of 50 to 80 miles away from the institution just because of the geographics of the area in which we're in. So you can look at an hour travel time to and from. By the time that happens and you get stuck 2 to 3 times a week, not only are you being exhausted, it's getting to the point where you physically are unable to come in and cover your shift, so you end up calling in for your shift later on in the week, thereby bucketing one of your fellow co-workers. Along with that, time off in the Department of Corrections is very hard. We have a very small relief factor. We can only allow so many people off at a time at an institution because it's mandatory that we have those posts full. So people, when they bid their vacations, they come few and far between. But it's important that we have time to do things with our kids. So people try to schedule that out as best they can. My son was a state wrestler. And I bid my shift and organized my life to where I could support my kid and his wrestling and travel with him when I needed to. The problem with it is when I get bucketed 3 out of 4 times in a month that he has a wrestling tournament, then I'm missing my kid's functions. You know, I've been bucketed through Christmas. I've missed many, many anniversaries and birthdays and holidays with my family because I get bucketed. And while we do that and we understand the need for that, it burns out the staff very, very quickly. When you start looking at the overtime hours, and they can talk about how many hours are mandatory and how many hours are not mandatory, what it comes down to is at Two Rivers Correctional Institution alone, we run anywhere from 10 to 20 posts short on a shift. So that means that 10 or 20 people are going to have to work overtime on one shift. If I'm the first person in the bucket, I have the option of saying, okay, I will go ahead and work it and be able to pick the desirable post I want to work to make it a little more palatable. Or I can tell them no, and everybody else will pick, and then I get stuck working a post that may not be quite as desirable. That last person or those last people are what they're calling mandatory overtime. When in actuality, that first person had no desire to stay. They knew they were going to have to stay, so they went ahead and said, yeah, I'll go ahead and volunteer to work this post so that I don't have to stay in a bad post. So then that's what I was talking about when I say the numbers are a little skewed when you start talking about mandatory versus voluntary. And I'm sorry, I don't want to disagree with them, but I would say that the mandatory overtime, if you look at it in that scenario, is actually a little higher than what people are projecting. I know I've had that myself many times at an institution. In a 3-month span at Two Rivers Correctional Institution, in just 3 months, I had well over 2,500 hours of overtime in 3 months, spread out amongst about 320 staff. So you think about that. That's a lot of time they're spent stuck at their institutions. You start looking at the wellness of these staff. We've had numerous studies done from Portland State that talk about how being inside of a correctional institution affects staff members. Our own director has talked about how she wants to minimize the time that people are in these institutions to a certain extent. Something has to be done to force that, and that's what we're coming to ask you today to help us do. Help us get something to where they have to have some type of oversight on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Are there on-call employees available for some of that work?
On call? No, sir. Because it's a 24/7 operation for the majority of the posts, every day when you come on shift, whether you're first shift, second shift, or third shift, every day they dictate or they'll designate who is quote unquote in the bucket. So there are some people that will sign up on a list and say, yeah, I'm available for overtime. That list is relatively small at most institutions. And they burn through that list quite fast, and then we still have a lot of people that are getting mandatory overtime. But there are people that do volunteer and say, yeah, I will do overtime. But even those people are getting burned out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Williamson. Roger, what's the rate of overtime pay?
Currently, as it stands right now, is time and a half, ma'am.
Between 10 and 20 people were paying time and a half every shift.
At some institutions, I won't say it's an everyday occurrence, but I will say on the grand average, almost every institution, at least one shift to two shifts throughout the day, you're going to be paying overtime to some sort.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Roger, I'm just trying to, I maybe didn't hear what you said clearly, but you were describing how many hours you've worked in the, or one time within a three-month period of time. How many hours?
Not myself, sir. That's out of Two Rivers Correctional Institution between November of 2016 and I believe January of 2017. I was trying to depict the total amount of overtime in those 3 months that was worked by the staff at that institution.
Okay, I got you.
And
thank
what
you.
What was the number?
It was 800 hours and
2,500 hours?
Or no, 2,400, didn't you say? In 3 months?
That was
2,400 hours.
Was it 24?
How many follow up?
Please.
How many employees was that involved?
How many employees?
280. About 280, sir.
280.
Okay. It comes out to about one shift a day.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
I'm trying to wrap my head around this. Is it a recruitment issue? Is it a management issue? Why are we facing this sort of mandatory overtime concept?
Chair Baker, members of the panel, this is a multifaceted problem. We have a recruitment issue out east. And actually throughout the department, we have a recruitment issue, so our numbers are down. A lot of our institutions are running below staffing. It's an overcrowding issue. We've crowded our institutions and put more and more inmates in them and have not increased our staffing to cover for that. So we're having to pull staff from posts that we had before to cover the new dormitories. It's a function of, as Mr. Baser was trying to explain, staff go through this cycle and it compounds. There's multifacets of what causes this. No, I don't think anybody is able to put their finger on it and say this is the one problem.
There's a national problem with law enforcement for recruiting, and as you can imagine, it is. This is a very difficult job for people. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barker. We are having this same conversation. We have the Department of Corrections up in the Public Safety Sub this week, and so we've been talking a lot about this in and outside of the building, or not outside the building, in and out of the committee hearing. So things that have been mentioned to me, I'm trying to track down the validity of these things right now. One of the things that I was told, and maybe you can validate this or not, that one of the institutions have decided to go ahead and fill all their FTE, and by doing so, by doing so, they had cut down drastically the amount of overtime that they had been using. I'm not sure if you are familiar with that or if you've seen that. I'm trying to get the numbers on that. Along those lines, Representative Greenlick asked about on-call workers. It's my understanding that they have like a relief worker that they're hiring for each position as well. Is that that fills in for the short-term and part-time leave and so forth? So I'm curious if you've heard about the one location that had cut down on their overtime, and anything about relief workers that are being hired.
I'll let Mr. Woolery answer that.
Chair Barker and Representative Stark, my name is Tim Woolery. I've worked for the Department of Corrections like my friend here for about 17, 18 years prior to coming to Oregon AFSCME 10 years ago. I'm currently the lead representative for the state of, I have people like Roger that assist me with that. I'll try to answer your question. There is institutions are almost always trying to have full staffing. There's difficulty in recruitment and retention in certain locations more than others. One of them is Coffee Creek up here in Wilsonville. They burn through their recruits really quickly, have a difficult time maintaining full staffing. Out east, we have difficulty maintaining full staffing. If they are able to have a full complement of staff, there's obviously less overtime, because one of the factors that causes people to have holes in the roster and need to be filled with overtime is the fact that we have vacant positions. So you're correct. If they had a full complement of staff, it would be better. And there was a second part to your question that I
already gone.
It's already gone.
In and out.
Sanchez.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Is there a reason why Coffee Creek? Can you have any idea why there would be such turnover at Coffee Creek? I can understand Eastern Oregon to a degree, but
Chair Barker and Representative Sanchez, one of the reasons is that's right in the mix of a number of other employment opportunities with counties that are higher paid, and that's one of the things, the challenges that we deal with. They start out about $1,000 a month better and have better benefits than the Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Chair Barker. This may not be a fair question for you guys. I asked this of the department yesterday. Being that I'm just learning about all these things, I was not aware until recently that historically there had been an issue with PERS stacking and you know, the idea of people intentionally calling in sick and in order to swap and make it so that people were still working and getting to work the overtime shift. When I asked about it yesterday, you know, the response was they hope that that doesn't happen, but there's a couple locations that they are suspecting that that's still happening. Are you guys aware of that? What is your response? And as you know, ask me, what is your kind of take on that, or what do you encourage people on that, or some sort of response on that?
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, it is something that we would never advise doing. I'm in my experience of 17 years, as well as the 10 years I have in this job, I know of nobody that does that intentionally and on purpose. What happens is people talk about the spiking of the PERS because of their overtime. We have overtime more than what we want. They don't churn through overtime just for the purposes of increasing their overtime, their PERS 20, 25 years from now. So I don't think that happens. There may be a rare instances where that, you know, somebody might do that on their own violation, but I have not. It's not been my experience that occurs.
Representative, just the experience I've seen in, like in Multnomah County, and people who work with, some people would volunteer for overtime in their last 3 years to build up their final average salary, but it wasn't as a conniving way. They weren't working with somebody else. They just would volunteer when the jobs came up. Anything else for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Call John Neese and Rob Bovet.
Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Williamson and Olson, and members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel Association of Oregon Counties. I think I'll be real quick. House Bill 2104 and 2105 are not intended to apply to anything outside of the Department of Corrections. However, one of those bills, 2104, the way it's written technically, might arguably apply to county jails, which have, well, 36 different circumstances than the circumstances you've heard. So I think that the sponsors would agree with me that if you are going to move forward on 2104, it should be clarified to apply just to DOC. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Okay, please. Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is John Neese. I'm Administrator of Human Resources for the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here to provide some information related to House Bill 2104. As you know, it requires an employer of security personnel in a corrections facility to pay employees three times their regular rate of pay in circumstances where they're required to work more than 40 hours in a week. Currently, DOC has approximately 4,500 employees, the majority of which work within the correctional officer series inside our facilities.
Well, Oregon is one of the safest correctional systems in the country. Staff must remain vigilant because they are often faced with the threats of violence and traumatic stressors that are inherent to working in a correctional environment. In addition, it's often difficult for employees to create a healthy balance between home and work life due to the nature of our business and the operations that we do every day. The department recognizes how overtime, especially mandatory overtime, impacts our employees, the readiness, their personal lives, and their individual health. Reducing the number of mandatory overtime assignments is critically important to us. In 2016, we established a strategic initiative to address the issue of mandatory overtime. We also want to understand the drivers that are impacting how many times mandatory overtime occurs. As a part of that initiative, we established two goals, the first being reducing mandatory overtime in 4 years by 20%, and then more a long-term goal of reducing mandatory overtime by 50% in 10 years. To address some immediate needs, we put together a work group to study overtime. We've partnered with our labor leaders, both AFSCME and AOCE. We've brought on managers onto the work committee, line staff, in addition to our labor leaders, to help us identify all those drivers of workplace and mandatory overtime, both voluntary and mandatory. In addition, our DOCE Chief of Security is conducting a review of each institution's staff deployment plan. This review is looking into how do we utilize our FTE positions and identifying any operational efficiencies that will assist us in reducing that overtime. Again, DOC understands the significant impacts of mandatory overtime, and we're committing to reducing its frequency. We're confident that these ongoing efforts will help us achieve our 4-year and 10-year goals to reduce overtime. If House Bill 2104 passes, it will have significant financial impact on our department. Given the ongoing study and conversations with labor management about these issues, the department believes this concept requires further review and discussion. I appreciate your time. I'm here to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. To go back and clarify, it was how much percentage in how many years?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, we are wanting to reduce mandatory overtime by 20% in 4 years.
Okay.
And then 50% in 10 years.
Follow up?
Please.
Just so that I have kind of the perspective of how long you've been working on this, how long would you say everybody that you described here, how long has this process been going on?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, the work group that I spoke of started in late 2016.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the obvious question I think that begs to be asked here is all those overtime costs, why are we not able to hire more people? Because certainly at time and a half, even with benefit packages, we're talking some pretty big dollars here. So what is the conversation at the department about filling more positions? Or you have them and you're not able to find people for them?
Yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Springer, great question. We have ongoing efforts within our recruitment team to identify ways to make ourselves unique and the employer in choice when it comes to public safety. As you know, there are many challenges in the law enforcement communities to attract qualified people. I think everybody is competing for the same folks. We have brought on additional recruitment individuals that are specific to our security team. We also have identified some additional recruitment efforts working with our institutions to host single-day recruitment events. So the one thing is for certain, we're going to continue to try to identify ways to make us more appealable and to get the word out about working for the Department of Corrections.
Follow up,
please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're trying to fill the positions, correct? You have positions,
ma'am.
And if somebody qualified today, applied, and could pass all the criteria, they'd get hired?
Well, they would go through the recruitment process, they'd be interviewed, and then...
Passed all the qualifications.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go for a moment to the perspective of 2105. And then I have a follow-up question. How does the department feel about having a board to assist in these budgetary issues?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, I believe the agency feels that many of our efforts that we've worked with our labor leaders and our community members, we have the opportunity to connect with them to identify what's driving the key overtime issues, which is the big part of the budget oversight. And I believe that we would want to continue those efforts to see that through, and we're confident in that relationship with our community members and our labor leaders to make them more aware of the budget process as we go mm-hmm. through that, and to make sure that nobody is left not knowing what our efforts are and knowing what the key drivers are and the key impacts.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Let me ask you a related question, and that is, right now, does the Department of Corrections have enough money to hire enough staff to do all of the jobs that need to be done?
Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, I would probably have to get back with you. I want to make sure that
I
answer correctly on that.
Yeah.
So I will gladly provide that information for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd get my head around the scope of the problem. Can you tell me roughly how many security employees you have and how many hours of overtime you paid in a year, say, or a period?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I believe our numbers are right around for security personnel. I'm going to say around 2,800. I can provide a specific number for you pretty easily.
And the hours, you have an estimate of the total number of hours you paid in overtime?
I can provide that information for you.
Thank you.
And
so also when we talk about all this overtime, is also the staff, like people that work, civilians that work in the institution that aren't actually part of the security? I mean, like people in the kitchen or the electricians or those kind of people?
Chair Barker, We do have some folks that volunteer from the community as volunteers, mainly religious services and things like that. But most of our employees, you mentioned food services, they're represented employees, they're Department of Corrections employees.
And they would count on these numbers we're talking about of people that have to work mandatory overtime?
You know, I'll have to check. You know, we obviously have mandatory overtime in situations occasionally with our food services folks and also some of our critical classifications like nurses,
right,
as well as our security folks.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I have a follow-up question to Representative Greenlicks. What percentage of the staff that we're talking about are eligible for retirement right now?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, great question. I'll get back to you and make absolutely for sure I provide you with that information.
At one point, I thought it was about 55%.
It could be.
35 yesterday.
Yeah.
35.
That sounds high, but like
yeah.
I said, I'll make sure I will get you the number.
Because as we talk about these recruitment problems or issues around recruitment, we have a an additional issue, which is people who could retire tomorrow and have openings that we're unable to fill the openings we have now. And can I have a follow-up comment?
Please.
Mr. Chair, so starting in 2013, I think after my first session when I chaired the Budget Committee for Public Safety, I started touring the facilities, all the Department of Corrections facilities. I think I got to almost all of them. I didn't make it to Lakeview, but I will get there at some point. And I did it without the central office knowing it. So I met with a lot of line staff, and to a person, they talked about the impact this has on their communities, on their families, the divorce rate, the suicide rate, the domestic violence rate, the drug and alcohol rate. These are really, really hard jobs. And without managing them correctly, there are broad reaching impacts into our communities around this kind of chronic stress. And so I think talking to folks about their personal experiences in this arena was really eye-opening to me. And so I know that the Department of Corrections has brought POPs in several budget cycles around the health of their employees. But I think this is key to all of this, is staffing issue we have to figure out, because we can add on wellness policy option packages. But what we're really talking about is staffing policy option packages. And until we solve that problem, we will continue to have these kinds of ripple effect into our communities for these employees.
Chair Barker, can I, Representative Williamson, I just want to say, you know, none of us want to tell one of our hardworking employees that, I'm sorry, you can't go home to your family, your plans are off. And so that's why it's important for us. We understand the impact of it. And, you know, they put in 8, sometimes 10 hours of hard work, and that's a difficult thing to do. So that's why we're looking at it as hard as what we are.
Thank you. And this, another thing about the stress level, that's got to be very stressful just to walk in that building. Mm-hmm. Any of them.
Sure.
And
lifespan.
It kicks up the noradrenaline, which is just deadly to people. I mean, mm-hmm. very, very hard on the system. And several years ago, there was a police psychologist that had a report about, for police officers, which isn't near as stressful, I don't believe, on a routine basis as being a corrections officer. Mm-hmm. When you get into the locker room and put on your uniform, if stress is 1 to 10, you're at a 6 right there. And then when the radio calls come out to remind you of the call you took before, you go up. And so you have some of those same things. But I would suspect that being a corrections officer starts at even a higher level of stress just getting in that building because of the danger all the time there, where mm-hmm. police sometimes, at least you know, slack off and go get a cup of coffee someplace else. And so anyway, so we really appreciate the work that your corrections officers are doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And absolutely, I think that's true. In fact, working as a police officer on the street, it was sometimes a great joy to be able to leave the person in corrections and not have to continue to interact with them, if you understand that. But the other thing was, when I talked to a lieutenant at Columbia River, I said, what is the most important thing that we could do for you at this facility? And he said, personnel, more personnel.
Yeah. Okay,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Testimony accepted. We'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2104, 2105, and open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2777.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2777 gives mass transit districts the authority to create an alternative administrative process for resolving violations. If a case is not resolved through the administrative process, the transit district could still charge the individual within 90 days of the citation being issued. HB 2777 would not require a rider to use the administrative process, and that rider could still opt into the standard court process. There are no amendments, and we have not received the fiscal revenue statements.
Okay, thank you. Aaron Dees, Eric Von Hagen, and Annalise Kohler, I think.
Good afternoon. Chair Barker, Vice Chairs Williamson and Olson, my name is Aaron Dees, and I'm a Government Affairs Manager at TriMet. With me today is Eric Van Hagen. He's Senior Deputy General Counsel for TriMet. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2777, a bill that will allow TriMet to establish an administrative procedure to handle fare violations. I'll give a general overview of how we got here, and Mr. Van Hagen will speak to the details of the bill and what we expect the process to be. Since opening the Blue Line Max to Gresham in the late 80s, TriMet has recognized that the honor system of payment requires a citation level high enough to encourage riders to purchase a ticket, but not so high that low-income riders are unable to pay the fine, possibly getting pushed into an ever-escalating cycle of fines and exclusions. TriMet's current citation for fare evasion is $175, which is high enough to discourage evasion, but clearly a challenge for low-income riders to pay. The balance between these two pressures has been difficult, and hence the genesis of 2777. In a nutshell, House Bill 2777 authorizes TriMet to establish an optional administrative procedure that will provide riders with choices on how to handle a violation. The rider may choose to pay a lower fine. They may choose to do community service. If the citation is satisfactorily resolved in timely fashion, it never reaches the court, and thus the rider will have no court record. However, the court system would still be available if the rider chooses or if the rider fails to resolve the citation in a timely fashion. We see this administrative process as much more humane way to handle citations while preserving the citation fine amount at a high enough level to encourage payment. I'll turn it over to Mr. Van Hagen to speak to the details and a few of the other benefits of the process, and thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, as Aaron said, my name is Eric Van Hagen. I'm a Senior Deputy General Counsel for TriMet, and I'm pleased to have the opportunity to speak with you about House Bill 2777. We think this bill provides an off-ramp for folks who are engaged in a fare evasion citation situation. We think it decriminalizes the process by removing the court system and brings about a better proportionality and balance into the appropriate responses to what generally amounts to a failure to pay a $2.50 transit ticket. The current system, I think there are others who will talk about the benefits of that policy and why it's a good thing. I just want to touch briefly on explaining kind of what the bill does, the mechanics of this process, and some very intentional reasons that we set it up in the way that we did. In the current system right now, if you did not have adequate proof of payment, you would most likely be issued a citation like this one. It would be filed in the court, and you would be able to pay it through the court immediately. It's like a traffic ticket. You would be given a summons and a copy of this complaint. You can appear and typically receive a reduction as a result of that complaint or an early payment, but you would still have a judgment entered in the system. What we've proposed in 2777 is that you would still be issued this citation, but for all intents and purposes, we would put it on a shelf for 90 days. During that 90-day period, there would be a couple options for the customer. They could make an administrative payment of less than the $175. That exact figure would in the bill be left to our board, but it obviously can't be more than $175. The bill would authorize TriMet to offer community service as an option for people who are not able to afford that payment. The amounts to be set again by the board. That's not something that's presently available in the court system. And the bill authorizes a in-house hearing as well to have a TriMet run hearing process as if somebody wanted to challenge the issuance of the citation. If the citation is resolved during that 90-day period through one of those methods, community service, payment of a fine, or it is adjudicated and found not to be valid, if it's resolved successfully, this citation now that we've sort of put on the shelf for 90 days is destroyed. It never hits the courts. So the individual would not have a record in the court system. There would be no judgment entered for the violation in the court system. And we found, and I think others will speak to this, that having that violation conviction there, even though it's a violation and not a crime in the traditional sense, can come up on searches of individuals. There are data brokers who mine that data, and it can become a problem for military service, for housing, and other services. We very intentionally left the court system as a key aspect of this process, and there are a couple of reasons why. The first one is that we want people to have the opportunity to have a neutral hearing. If they feel like they need to get in front of someone who's a neutral and detached judicial official, they will have that option under this program. They can go to the court system and get that. It would then be adjudicated like a normal citation like they are today. The other advantage is that for those who don't pay, who don't appear, who essentially default on their citation, there is now going to be a judgment entered in the court system. So we would have the benefit of the entry of judgment and the corresponding collection capabilities that you have with the court judgment that you don't have if it was a purely internal process and we didn't have the court system there. The third reason is that keeping the court system there, I think, provides some balance into this proposal in that it creates a situation where our board will have an incentive to really create a system as we get into the details. You know, how much is this fine going to be? That's obviously one of the unanswered questions in this bill. Our board's going to have to find the sweet spot there. And because if it's not a better deal than going to court, people are just going to, they've still got that court option. They're going to go to court. So we're going to have to find a spot where we can offer an administrative payment in an amount that is right for, you know, the needs of the district and the needs of our riders and gets people involved and participating in this. There are some, you know, of these policy considerations that are left to our board as part of this bill, and we would continue to work with community groups and others in the hopes that we could continue to refine that process. Just by way of background, TriMet issues in a two-year period, we issue about 43,000 fare evasion citations on our system district-wide, so about 21,500 per year. And so that is sort of in a nutshell what the process would be and what we hope to achieve in this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Yeah, I have a question. Ms. Van Hagen, so I'm assuming there's no equal protection issue here because the 90 days allows for a voluntary process by the person who's been cited, right?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Williamson, yes. We would absolutely believe that another advantage of this bill is a 90-day is a quick process. It's got to be resolved quickly, and if it doesn't, it's just going to go to the court system. I don't think it's an answered question yet ever whether there are speedy trial considerations for violations.
That was going to be my next question.
And the answer is, you know, very few cases go up on appeal for violations is the reality of it, because of the nature of the interests involved usually don't lean towards that. So I can't say for sure whether there are speedy trial considerations because I don't think that question has ever been clearly answered. I do think our hope is that a 90-day pause is enough to then allow on the other side the criminal process or the court process for the violation
in a timely manner
that a 90-day stay would give us enough time to do what we need to do but give the courts enough time to process these through because they do move through pretty quickly.
Thank you.
Sorry, you don't have it finalized how it's going to work out, I don't believe, but so I'm asking, so are you going to place a limit on that somebody can, after so many times they fair evasion, you're going to just go ahead and move them on up?
Yeah, Chair Barker, that is the bill allows us to designate both the types of citations. You know, obviously we're talking mainly about fare. That's right. By far the big. There are a handful of others, smoking, a few other, but really the bulk of these are fare evasion. The bill gives us the ability to consider subgroups of evasion of fare evasion. So we could do first time, second time, or first time. There's been some talk about this being an option only for first time offenders. Our biggest goal is to change behavior. And we're going to find a way. Our goal will be to craft that sort of the next phase of this policy with our board in such a way that we can change the most behavior. But the bill does allow us to designate first and second time offenders in that process.
And I'm pleased to see it move to the civil to a civil settlement kind of thing. It makes more sense. I ride the train not frequently but often, and I've never been on there where inspectors haven't come on and they haven't picked somebody off, at least one or two people in the car that haven't paid their fares. But and while we do this, I do hope TriMet keeps it so that keeps it orderly, so that we don't regret retrograde back to the days when Neil Goldschmidt had to put the Oregon State Police on those trains to make the public feel safe. I'm concerned about that. So hopefully this will be a good solution to that.
Okay. Any other questions before I go?
Sure. Okay. I could just make a comment. Yeah. Slightly off topic. We had hearings last week on the 370 population.
Excuse me.
We had hearings on the aid and assist population last week.
Yeah.
One of the things TriMet's been very helpful in promising to change their behavior around interference with public transit, but not using it in the same way for people who are just on the platform and they've been banned and a variety of other issues. I'd like to thank them for that work.
Thank you. Good, nice comment. All right, you're on.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Annalisa Curler, and I am here representing TriMet's Transit Equity Advisory Committee, also known as TEAC. And I am here today to express our support for this bill. The TriMet Transit Equity Advisory Committee is a TriMet advisory committee representing a diverse cross-section of community leaders charged with providing insight and guidance to TriMet's general manager on transit equity and access issues. Members of the committee represent a diverse population, including minorities and low-income communities that are disproportionately transit-dependent. This committee has spent part of the last year looking very specifically at TriMet's fare enforcement program. This came up on our work plan because we had heard from a variety of the constituencies that we represent that they really wanted to see some change in how fare enforcement was done at TriMet. They felt like it really created a negative environment. They felt targeted. They felt like there was really ample room for some changes to come about. So in response to that, this committee did a very deep dive on TriMet's fare enforcement program. We looked at data, we looked at the different policies and procedures they had in place, we talked to our own constituencies, we attended focus groups with transit-dependent riders to kind of hear their thoughts and feedback on fare enforcement programs. And then earlier this fall, we developed a set of recommendations for TriMet to look at to reform their fare enforcement program. We were very happy to see late fall that TriMet adopted a number of those recommendations to reform their fare enforcement program. This bill is an example of one of those recommendations. Specifically, we really asked if TriMet could look at solutions to decriminalize their fare enforcement program. When we talked to riders, they said that the $175 fine was really quite steep. Often the reason why they receive a citation is because they don't have the $2.50 or $5 for the day fare. And so you can imagine if you don't have $5, you don't have $175 either. Mm-hmm. So were there ways to have community service be an option or have a fine that is less high, essentially? Riders also spoke to us about the desire to just avoid the court system entirely. These guys spoke about some of the issues in regards to having something on your record in terms of housing and military service and other issues like that. In addition, we also heard that it can take a long time during that day when you go down to the court system. Many low-income workers don't have vacation time or sick time or those types of things that they can use in order to get down and spend the entire day at the courthouse. So this would give them an avenue to get out of that. So again, we would really love your support for this bill, and we're looking forward to working with TriMet on kind of fleshing out some of those details that Eric spoke about. Let me know if you have any questions.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This could be for any one of you. In terms of potential community service, we know that a lot of folks that ride on TriMet are disabled. And so would you have options so that it wouldn't be just community service for the able-bodied, but for people that are physically challenged?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, I can take a stab at answering that question. We've, at the early stages, discussed what a community service program might look like. And sort of, you know, one option would be to work with established community organizations, mm-hmm. who have, some of them have court-appointed or other, you know, school-mandated volunteer hours. And so they have systems, and they're generally large organizations that have a tracking system in place that allow you to complete your community service. Oregon Humane Society, some of those kind of larger, more established organizations. Particularly initially, that seems like a good place for us to start to get a program up and running, to rely on some of those existing organizations to build a community service plan around that. The other option would be to have a community service option where people are doing some kind of TriMet-related work that is not, you know, already being done and covered under our collective bargaining agreement. And that would require a lot more, you know, administrative, you know, expense probably to set that up. So at least initially, until we can get a program up and running, that's what we've been looking towards. And I think that would provide, an equitable options, as well as a lot of different timing options for folks, that they could do it in a way that meets their schedule, because we want to, you know, be able to accommodate them if they're going to choose that route.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And this looks like a good program. Really hope it works. If it doesn't, feel free to come back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, committee or witnesses. And the next call, Kimberly McCullough and Sybil Hibb.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon in support of House Bill 2777. We've had a number of concerns over the years and particularly recently about the fair and enforcement policies and practices and how those things are resolved related to TriMet. In particular, we're concerned about low-income individuals who may be unable to pay fines, who can end up in a situation where they face higher and higher escalating fines, potential exclusion. That exclusion can last up to 90 days, which can really interfere with a person's ability to live their life, take care of their children, get to work, do all the things that they need to do. And then also the potential for criminal charges for repeat fare evasion. We were also concerned in December when there was data that came out that showed significant racial disparities with which riders were caught without a ticket on a max and ended up being banned. And after that data came out, Multnomah County did actually stop charging. They've changed their policies, so they've stopped charging with IPT. It's interfering with public transit, which is a Class A misdemeanor. So under their current policy, they have stopped charging for that. But that was something that could happen if you ended up with repeat fare evasion, and it still is something on the books. So we see this bill as one piece of a larger need for policy reform. One of the things that we would really like to see is increased access to bus passes for people with disabilities and people who are living in lower income levels. We think that would actually end up reducing the number of people who are caught on the trains and the buses without a ticket. I just want to flag for you that we also support a bill that's on the Senate side right now, Senate Bill 357, which would go ahead and remove IPT, the interfering with public transit, from the books. That wouldn't mean that folks who were caught without tickets repeatedly would not be able to be prosecuted. It would just remove that elevated Class A misdemeanor, and it would leave criminal trespass and disorderly conduct, which are Class C and Class B misdemeanors. And because of the disparities there and the impact on low-income folks, we think that reducing criminalization there is another piece of the puzzle. So we'd like to see both of these bills pass.
Thank you very much, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here, also in support of House Bill 2777. And I think I just have two pieces to add. One, I would say, is that our clients, low-income clients, are disproportionately dependent upon transit. It's how they get to their doctor's appointments. It's how they get to visit their families. It's how they get to school or to work. And so if I were a queen for a day, I would ensure that everybody had access to free public transit, and we really appreciate it where it exists. And also appreciate this effort to make sure that if there are violations, that this kind of a citation is not something that becomes one of those things that kind of further cycles people into poverty. Class A misdemeanor conviction can have a significant collateral consequence, as you all know, on housing, on employment, on credit, on many other aspects of life that are a struggle for low-income people. And right now, I would say our clients' population as a whole are struggling just so greatly, and this creative way of looking at ways to have an administrative processing of small violations is very useful, especially the opportunity to do community service as an alternative to a criminal sanction or to a fine. And I would just like to add one piece related to the discussion about waivers or alternative methods of allowing people to serve their community service if a person has a disability, if a person has a mental illness, if a person is so low income that they are unable to pay $2 for a bus fare. Are they ever going to have any hope of paying off $175 of a fine? I'd like to see the implementation as it moves forward consider the concept of waivers or deferrals, and I think there's some great models to look at that the Judicial Department and other agencies have implemented, and hope that that TriMet will look at that as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes,
are there going to be further?
Pardon me.
Are there going to be further testimony from anybody else?
No.
No. Okay. Well, then maybe it's a question for you or for counsel. This was at the request of TriMet, and everything I'm hearing today is TriMet. So, how many mass transit districts are in Oregon right now, and would these affect all of them? Would this affect all of them?
That's a good question.
Or is this just TriMet? Sorry, I probably should have asked you.
It's not a bad question.
Coming
Mr.
back.
Van Hagen, maybe.
I don't know.
Aaron.
Hi. Aaron Dees with TriMet again. Chair Barker, this would also include Lane Transit District and Salem-Keizer.
So is that's all there are? They're just three?
Mm-hmm.
And the language is May? Is
yeah, the language is they may create an administrative process, so okay. It'd be up to them.
But it's basically TriMet is the one that's asking for this.
That's
because I was just curious if Salem or any Eugene or anybody else wanted to come in here and talk about this today.
Follow up,
Mr. Yes.
So, how is that different than like SMART? Is SMART not a transit that would be?
Chair Barker, Representative Wild, SMART I think is operated by the city.
Oh, that's true. It's operated by Wilsonville. So. Right. They wouldn't be in the same status as a transit district.
Chair Barker, Representative Al, they are not considered a mass transit district. There are various classifications of trans districts. Mass transit is generally the largest category.
Okay.
I would suspect that SMART wouldn't be having the issue of the non-pavement affairs. Mm. Like, I don't know, can you get on there without you? Like, if you get on, you have to pay a fare? See, in the bus and the trains, you don't.
You don't have to pay at the door. You can get on a train, for example, in Wilsonville and head north, and you don't have to pay at the door. You buy at a kiosk.
Yeah, right. Okay.
But so it feels like it's the same thing.
Well, Wes is managed by SkyMet. They would be included in it.
Yeah.
That's true. And Wes is the train that goes north out of Wilsonville. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. And we did just get in the fiscal, so we're able to take it. We just closed the public hearing and opened a work session on House Bill 2777.
Have at her.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2777 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2777 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
I'd love to carry that, Mr. Chair.
The train man, Mitch Greenwich, will be the carrier.
Oh, he got you first. I wanted it, too.
Yeah.
We're going to get him a senior citizen pass for free.
I know.
Buddy, are you looking in the mirror lately?
We're still on.
I was.
Are we going to adjourn?
Yeah.
Are we going to adjourn?
Yeah.
I was.